This week I will introduce a few other things. Today I want to introduce the language Julia to you. I mentioned some of the advantages and disadvantages of the language Mathematica, and I want to introduce Julia as an alternative that may be useful for certain projects. And there are in particular two things where Julia stands out as compared to Mathematica. I'm going to explain later what Julia is. One, it is open source and freely available. That is, everybody, including collaborators, can easily install it on their laptop or on a supercomputer. And second, the language is designed to be fast. Mathematica is designed to be comfortable. It has also symbol processing. And Julia is more designed to be fast. It's in the same class of languages as C or Fortran or something. And for certain kinds of applications where you do have to solve large problems, that's an important property. So today, this morning, and then this afternoon in the tutorial, I'm going to introduce the language to you, and this afternoon I can also help you install the language and everything on your laptop in case you have trouble with that. But let's begin. The language is called Julia, and it's a high-level dynamic language. I don't know in how far you're familiar with computer languages. There are kind of several classes or families of computer languages, and Julia actually falls in the same class of Mathematica. They trace back to Lisp, one of the earliest programming languages that were designed to be elegant from a mathematical or computer science point of view, as opposed to the other class of languages that kind of traces back to Fortran and that take a very much an engineering approach. It needs to be mapped efficiently to the hardware, need to run fast, but that also means that some of the more higher level or comfortable properties are not there in these languages. In particular, something that Mathematica and Julia have in common is called introspection. That is, when you write a code or a program or a function, that function can look at itself. So in Mathematica, if you have an expression, I showed you how to look at the expression tree and everything, and that is really nice and can be quite useful. And Julia has similar features. In other languages, Fortran and C++ lack these features, and that means it is more difficult to have programs or code that talks about code. So if you want to write a function that produces another function, that should be rather easy or straightforward in Mathematica and Julia. It's much more difficult in languages such as C++ or Fortran. And what people do in these languages, usually you write code and the code writes something, a file to disk, and then you read the file in a C++ file. That, of course, is a long way around and complicated and much more cumbersome to do. So in the first 20 minutes or so, I will simply introduce the language, give you a whirlwind tour, and later on I want to repeat the exercise that we did with Mathematica. Namely, we're going to take some functions that live in some function space, approximate them via Chebyshev functions, and calculate derivatives and so on. This will give you a comparison between Mathematica and Julia. I will also give you a bit of a concrete example. So here's a website for Julia, julialang.org. If you want to install it, want to learn more, obviously you can go there and look at all at the everything. So let me skip that. What I have here is a notebook that is an IPython or iJulia notebook, or it's also called JupyterHub these days. It's a kind of a generic web-based user interface for many languages, originally for Python, now also for Julia, and it looks very similar to what you would do in Mathematica. So if you type something in here, for example, 2 plus 3, shift return, the result is 5. You would have expected that. And of course, in Mathematica, you could now do something, whatever, x squared minus x of so, to perform some kind of calculation. Obviously here, this is going to be an error because x is not actually defined. So it's more of a language similar to Python, if you know Python. Yeah, I'm just going to wing it and tell you something that you can do here. Julia has arrays, so if you write 1, 2, 3, 4, that gives you an array of number or a list of numbers. And all objects in Julia are strongly typed. It's different to Mathematica. In Mathematica, if you have a list, it's a list, and you need to look at the list to see what's in there. Here we have explicitly an array of int 64. That means this array holds only integers and can only hold integers. If you make it larger, you can only put integers in there, otherwise it's an error. If you look at an element, you know ahead of time that you're going to get an integer, and this is one of the key features where Julia derives its efficiency that makes it much faster than Mathematica in certain applications. You can write a comprehension, for example, n squared for n in 0 to 9, which gives you, as you expect, a 10-element array, giving the squares less than 100. Oh, can you read that, or should I increase the screen size? No one complains. I'm sure it's fine. You can do something with strings. For example, hello, world. And concatenating strings in Julia uses the multiplication operator as if strings form some kind of group. It's a bit strange, but sure, it works. You can define functions. So for example, let's write a function f of x, and that function calculates x squared plus 1. You write it like this. That's now a function. And then, of course, f of 4 gives 17, and f of 4.0 gives 17.0. Julia makes these distinctions between integers and reals, and they're also complex numbers. 4 plus 2 im. So im is the imaginary unit. Mathematica use this uppercase I to ensure there is no conflict between the lowercase I that you might want to use as a variable name. So in Julia, they use im instead of I. And that is then 13 plus 16 im. So this is now a complex integer number, and you can also use complex numbers based on complex numbers over the reals. So which is then 13 plus 16 im with a dot zero here. And if you calculate 1 over 2, Mathematica would leave it like this. By default, Julia evaluates it as a real number. Julia has explicitly rational numbers where they use this double division sign. That is 1 half. And of course, 2 over 4 is also 1 half. And there are integers by default are efficient integers that have certain strange properties, in particular that they can overflow. So for example, 10 to the 10 has 10 zeros, as you expect, and 10 to the 100. A zero. There was an overflow somewhere in there. You can write big, and that gives you arbitrary precision integers that are slower, but they don't have this overflow problem, and then you get exactly what you expect. If you write pi, then by default, Julia keeps it as an irrational constant. You can convert it to a floating point number, and then you get something like 15 digits, and you can convert it to a high precision floating point number, and then you get approximately whatever that is, 100 digits or something. Yeah. I don't know in how far you are familiar with programming or are familiar with Mathematica. Let's continue a bit further. Julia has an if statement, so let's write a function. Function, whatever, switch, n, if n equals 0, then we return 1. Else if n equals 1, then we return, whatever, 10. Else if n equals, not just else, we return n squared or something, right? So this is now a function. And the last expression in the functions is automatically returned. In other languages, you need to write explicitly a return statement. In Julia, you don't need to do that if what you're returning is the last expression. The value of an if statement is whatever the last thing that is evaluated here. So this function does exactly what you naturally expect it to do. So switch of 0 is 0. And switch of 12, no, is 144. Julia has tuples, 1, 2.0, which are just arbitrary length collections that can have an arbitrary type. And everything in Julia has a type. So you can ask for the type of function. That's a tuple. First element is an integer. The next element is a floating point number. And the third element is a string. And you could also have written this in the shortcut notation like this. And Mathematica, what operator was that? I think it was slash slash or something, where you apply a function by give the function after the expression. You can also do that here. Type of, that's sometimes easier to write. So this is the same as the expression before with type of. And then, of course, you can also have loops in Julia for I in 1 to 10. Output I and I squared. Just exactly what you think it does. Haha, yeah, but it would have been nicer with a bit of a space in here, but let's do that. Actually, you can also do this much nicer with what is called string interpolation. So we just output a string, and it is string, we output I and I squared. So if you see a dollar sign in a string that gets back into the actual Julia code where something is evaluated and converted into a string and then output, that's a nice formatting way. In C and C++, you'd lose something with percent, and Python has something similar that creates easy, nice looking output. And here, of course, I need to have parentheses around I squared. If I didn't do that, the dollar sign would apply only to the I. So since I don't want to assume that you're familiar with programming, I'm just giving you these things as a quick overview. If you use Mathematica, you see it's very similar, except the syntax is all different. Mathematica is an uppercase if or which statement. Here it's lowercase. The loop here is written in for. In Mathematica, you would write table or do or something. But apart from that, things are very similar. In Mathematica, you can have this symbol processing that is also possible in Julia. Okay, let me explain it like this. If you write x squared in Mathematica, then this expression can have two very different meanings. And that depends whether the symbol x has a meaning or not. If x is defined ahead of time, it has a particular value, then x squared tells Mathematica to evaluate that expression. If x is 2, x squared will be 4, so that is the result. However, if x is unknown to Mathematica, then this is a symbolic tree, an expression tree that should be returned as is. So in one case, you tell Mathematica you kind of create an expression tree. And in the other case, you tell Mathematica to evaluate something. These are very different things, and it only depends whether x is defined or not. That's, of course, if you use Mathematica interactively, that is quite convenient. If you write a large program, then you might get the distinction wrong. Someone might have accidentally introduced the global variable x, and you think you're getting an expression tree, but now something is evaluated. And Julia makes this distinction explicit. By default, something is evaluated, but if you quote an expression, you get the expression tree. And quote, you do that with a colon operator. I don't know why they chose that. And so colon, and then in parenthesis, the expression x squared, this gives you an expression tree, which is just x squared. And we can also probably dump that tree. Let's see where that works. Yep. So this, I mean, it doesn't look as nice as Mathematica's tree structure, but it looks very similar. So you see the overall type here is an expression. The head of expression is the symbol call. Call is a function call because the power operator is internally a function call. The actual function that you're called is that symbol, that up arrow, which is the power operator. And it has two arguments, the symbol x and the integer 2. And that type is irrelevant here. Probably has to do with Julia's type inference algorithm. And if you have a longer expression, then you can, instead of a colon, also use quote, and then expression, and then end, which returns something very similar. So this is how you can handle expressions in Julia. And if you want to write a routine or a code that, for example, takes a derivative of an expression, then, of course, if you want to take a derivative, you need to have access to the definition of something. So if you the Mathematica derivative operator, the d thing or the derivative or something, that actually takes as input not the value of something that has been evaluated, but the full expression tree. So the definition of this d operator in Mathematica internally sets a special flag that the argument should not be evaluated, but rather the argument should be passed as expression. And you can do similar things, but since you have access to an expression tree here in Julia, you can also write a symbolic derivative operator in Julia. It's not part of base Julia, but if you look at the Julia package, I think it's Julia diff or something, it's actually a whole set of packages, are ways of calculating derivatives either numerically or symbolically in Julia. So these things exist as well, but unlike Mathematica, they're not part of base Julia, because base Julia is more geared towards programming similar to Fortran, but these things are possible, which means Julia is a very modern language compared to, say, Python or Fortran and so on. Is there something else I should mention? Let me just leave it at this if you don't have questions. I now want to move on to the example, to repeating the same example that we did in Mathematica, to solving PDEs. We are expanding something in Chebyshev functions. Are you familiar with Chrome? I want to get rid of some of the lines further up. I mean, kind of the top half of the screen is taken up by all these header lines and so on.
Control C.
Control C, B. No, that just moved down a bit. So this is a Mac, so I tried Command CB, which is usually a translation if it's Windows. Okay. Okay, well, let's not spend time with that. Oh, wait, look, I can scroll. No, I can't. Can't scroll. Okay. So, yeah, if you want to do plotting in Julia, you have to use a package for plotting. There are several plotting packages. So here I'm using a package called plots. So let's just load that package in the beginning so that we use it. And I'm also going to define a function called chop. You know, when numbers are output, they often have 15 digits. And when, you know, I want to present something on the screen, it's too much. I just want 6 digits. And sometimes a number is 10 to the minus 15. And that's rather inconvenient to look at. I rather want to output 0 on the screen instead. So I define this function chop that does exactly that. And the first, can you see that, or is that smaller now than before? Well, first we round x to 6 digits, and if x is 0, then we replace it with 0, otherwise we keep x. The thing is that floating point numbers actually make a distinction between plus 0 and minus 0, and seeing minus 0 is also, I don't like it in this context here. So I'm going to replace minus 0 with plus 0. So let's first define the Chebyshev functions. We're defining a constant. Yes?
Can you make it a bit bigger?
Thank you. I was looking for that. Now, how do I do that? Control plus. Okay, there. Hey, that worked. Okay, that's 10%. More? Yeah, let's do more, right? No, that's 25% better. Okay, good. So we're defining nmax, which is the same as we had before. It's the number of functions we want to have in our function space. So let me write comments here. Number of basis functions. Highest basis function, because we set it to 4, but since the lowest basis function is 0, we're actually getting 5 basis functions. This is an empty thing. We don't need that. And then we define, I'm inserting text here, which slows me down, which is probably good. And then going to explicitly define the Chebyshev functions. I'm sure there's a nicer way to do that. I also looked at some packages, but the packages I found, they did this in a very elegant manner. You couldn't just get the Chebyshev function, but rather there are efficient ways to evaluate them, which is really good. What you want to do is a Clench or algorithm and everything, but it's a bit more complicated than what I want to present today. So I'm going to rather define them manually here. And this is how the function looks like. So look, really primitive. There's a function I call chep. It takes the argument, n, obviously the index, and x, the value. And there's just a large if statement. If n is 0, the result is 1. If n is 1, then it's x, 2x squared, blah, 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 and so n, until for, say, n equals 6, you have 32x cubed, and so on. And for anything else, I throw a bounds error. I don't support these values of n. Obviously, this could be extended. And obviously, the Chebyshev function should be defined in a more generic manner. But here, that will do. And now here, as an example, we are evaluating the Chebyshev functions. And you should be able to read the syntax now. The square brackets that you see here, meaning is an array comprehension. That is what would be a table in Mathematica. Then I create a tuple here, where I evaluate the nth Chebyshev function at minus 1, at 0, and plus 1. And n loops of all the basis functions that I want to use. And then I chop the result so that it looks a bit more nicely, and you don't get to have so many digits to z. That takes a bit. And as you see, the Chebyshev functions are at the left boundary at minus 1, either 0, 1, or plus 1. The right boundary, they're all plus 1. And at the origin, they all happen to be either 0, plus 1, or minus 1. Probably looks good. We also want to plot the Chebyshev functions because that looks nicely. So that is a plot command. What I give here is a list of function. X goes to Chebyshev of n, x. That's the what we did in Mathematica with the hash and the ampersand. And n loops, again, over all the basis function. And that here is a function with an unknown x, that is called a lambda expression or an anonymous function in Julia, and we plot it from minus 1 to plus 1 in steps of 0.01. So Julia will calculate, evaluate the function at 201 points, and then probably use something like a linear interpolation in the plot. This needs to load the blocking package, and I'm actually not running this on my notebook. I'm running it on a workstation remotely, and the file systems there is a bit of 100 times more slow than I'd like it to be, but what can you do? So this will take a few seconds since it now needs to load the package, and that might take a bit. There you are. These are the Chebyshev functions, and of course, you know them from last week, exactly how you'd expect them to be. And of course, you can modify the plot by changing the labels, color scheme, and so on and so forth. We're not going to do that here. Oh, what happened here? Oh, no. Good. Now, after that, what we did last week, we used symbolic evaluation of many integrals. And that was the part that made Mathematica a bit slow, what took a bit of time, but also would have made it impossible to use 10 or more more basis functions. And what I'm going to use here, I'm going to use a Gauss-Lobato integration. I mentioned that in the end of the lecture. What that means, that over your integral, you choose a particular set of points, and at these points, you evaluate the function, and then you choose a particular linear combination of all these function values with particular weights that depend on the integration value, and that gives a rather accurate integration. And here, with the basis, with five basis functions, I'm going to choose five of these integration points. And nodes is the location of the points that I want to do here. So let me describe that here. So, and for Chebyshev functions, one particular way of choosing the locations of the point, if you just take the fraction n over n max, and then minus cosine pi of that value, so cos pi is a function of cosine of pi something, and this corresponds to these points. Let me draw that here on the blackboard. It's the same sketch we had last time. That is at interval, we choose two points at the boundary of the interval, and then three points in the interior. So we get 5 points overall because we chose five basis functions. And then we don't have an equal spacing here, but rather they cluster at the end of the interval, and that gives a much higher accuracy. So here it looks approximate like that. You see the value is not 0.5, but something like 0.7, 1 over square root of 2. And if you add more points in here, then whatever it might then look like this, and you see the density of the points near the boundary is much larger than in the interior. And now I want to choose the integration weights for the Gauss integration. And I'm going to do this in the following manner. I want to be able to integral polynomials up to order 4, and those should be integrated exactly. That means if I have any function living in the basis space that I'm spanning, I want the integration to be exact. And of course, for other functions that don't live at that function space, there will be a particular error. So yes, require that polynomials of order up to n max . So what we're doing now, we are going to choose 5 polynomials, x to the 0, x to the 1, x to the 2. And we see what values they have at these nodes that we just chose. And then we're going to solve the respective linear system to find the weights to ensure that the integration is exact. So first we check the values of the polynomials, which is just x to the I. For all I up to the polynomial order, for all x in the nodes that we chose. So these are the values of the polynomials at nodes that we chose. So for example, x to the 0 is 1 everywhere, of course. X, what? Sorry, getting confused here. No, this is x to the 0, which is 1 everywhere. And then just the linear function, of course, is just the value of the nodes that you're getting here. X squared is just the square root of the above, and so on and so forth. And this is the value of x to the 4th at the nodes that we chose at the collocation points, at the Gauss-Dubato integration points. And then we define another array holding the values of the integrals of these polynomials. Of course, we know how to integrate a polynomial x to the I over the interval from minus 1 to plus 1. So if I is odd, the result will be 0. And if I is even, it's just 2 over I plus 1. So these are these values here. Of course, that is much more accurate. It's just truncated in the output. And then we solve the respective linear system. So poly values is a matrix. Poly integrals is a vector. And with this backslash operator, you kind of divide that matrix by the vector in the sense of solving the respective linear system. That's a very compact notation. If you know MATLAB, you might be familiar with that. And of course, in other languages, this would be called like DGESV or something, solve a general matrix system or something. And of course, there's ample documentation in Julia that explains all this, gives tutorial. Today, I just give an introduction. So these are the weights associated with nodes. That is, if we want to integrate an arbitrary function, we evaluate it at the left boundary, x minus 1, multiply that function value by this value here. What is that? 0.06, 1 over 16 or something? 1 over, I don't know. And evaluate it at minus 0.7, at 0, plus 0.7, and plus 1, and this scale each function value by these numbers. And you will notice that the sum of these numbers is 2. That means if you have a constant function that you evaluate, then that constant function, the integral of the constant function, will evaluate to 2, which it should be, since we integrate the constant function from minus 1 to plus 1. We can do this in a function. So this is a function that numerically integrates another function on the interval from minus 1 to plus 1. So we pass as argument the function f. We take the weight, the respective node, evaluate f at the respective node, multiply with the weight, do this for all the nodes that we have, I to n max, put the respective thing into an array, sum over all the elements of the array, and that we have a discrete integration, which is then a summation, and we can test this. I should probably add a comment here. Hey. And for example here, we can integrate the cosine function from minus 1 to plus 1. And numerically, we get the result of 1.68 something. I mean, you can also evaluate the real value, which is, of course, sine of plus 1 minus sine of minus 1, because sine is the antiderivative. And that gives a very similar result. So our integration procedure is rather accurate. Even though we evaluated a function only at 5 points here, we're already getting 5 digits or something of accuracy. And of course, if we increase the number of collocation points, becomes exponentially more accurate. Okay. Next, I want to expand a function in the Chebyshev basis. In Mathematica, we use these accurate symbolic integration for that. Here I'm going to do it numerically. In Mathematica, this also projected any function onto the space on the truncated function space that we are treating. Here I'm not going to do that, I'm just going to assume the function already lives in that truncated function space. So this is a function that takes sample values, that takes any function's input and samples that function at the values at the location of the nodes that we have. And for example, if we do it with the function sine of pi times x, we get these values. And of course, sine of minus pi is 0, sine of 0 is 0, and so on. And sine of whatever pi over square root of 2 happens to be minus 0.8, and so on. Okay, I should probably take a step back and explain this a bit more slowly. The idea here is take any function, expand it in our Chebyshev basis, and to truncate the expansion, yeah, right, at n max. And we're going to do that in several steps. First, we are going to evaluate the function at each of the nodal points. Evaluate all basis functions at each of the nodal points. And then we're going to read off the basis coefficients of the expansion, which means we are solving the respective linear system. And that allows us to expand any function in terms of coefficients. And we're also going to do a fourth thing. In a Chebyshev expansion, you can expand a function in terms of the Chebyshev polynomials. But now we have this set of nodal points. We can also use a different basis, which is called a position basis, where we instead use the value of the function at these nodes to represent the expanded function. And then we can convert forth and back. It's a transformation between two bases. So there's a corresponding matrix that performs this transformation. Right. Yeah, and you see modal and nodal representation. Of course, these are very similar words that mean exactly the opposite. That's another, I don't know, something people like to have this kind of cool representation. So here we have a function that evaluates the basis function at each of the nodes. Sorry. And the result, of course, is a matrix. We have five basis functions evaluating each basis function at five nodes. So it's 5 by 5. And if you know how the Chebyshev polynomials look like, then you see that this makes sense. For example, the first, the zeros Chebyshev function is constant 1 everywhere. That this would be here, this column. The next one is just x, so these are just the nodal points, and so on, and so forth. We're going to invert this matrix. This is the matrix that we're using for. And this is indeed the inverse. And a function to convert a set of function values to a set of coefficients is then just multiplying the vector of function values with the weights of the coefficients, the respective inverse. And yeah, I should have another example here. So if you take the the function sine of pi x. Let's go slowly here. So we consider this function, then we evaluate f at all nodal points. Read off the basis coefficients. So the function x goes to sine pi x is called sine pi. And if we evaluate it at all the nodal points, then we have these function values, same as above. And if we read off all the basis coefficients, that was the functions that multiplies with the respective matrix. And these are then, is then the Chebyshev expansion. And if we do this step and go backwards again to the function values, then we see that this subtract the original, that the result is actually zero. Now above, we have a way to take any function and find its Chebyshev expansion. Now we also want to have an inverse. Given a particular Chebyshev expansion, you want to reconstruct the original function. Which is exactly how you think it should work. We take the coefficients of the Chebyshev expansions, multiply with the respective Chebyshev functions, do this for all our basis functions, and sum the result up. And the result is a function, so return a function. X goes to Chebyshev of X, and so on. And in Mathematica, you would now be able to actually see the polynomial expression because you get an abstract function out, so you see how it looks as a polynomial. Here we do it all numerically, so it's you can't look into the function, you can also evaluate the function. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to plot the respective function. So I'm using this function that we used at expansion as an example, sine pi x. We evaluate it at the nodal points. We convert it to the Chebyshev expansion. Then we reconstruct the function again. And I call this sine pi 1, because it's the approximate sine pi function. And then I'm plotting these two functions in the interval minus 1 to plus 1. And you see it looks similar, but there's a bit of a difference here. And the result here should be similar to what you saw in Mathematica. It should be slightly less accurate here because we didn't properly project into the function space. We just assumed it lives in the function space. That introduces an additional error. And we can also plot the difference between the original function and our approximation. And this is a difference. So the difference is about 0.15 or 1 over 6, given that the function goes up to 1. I think that's reasonable, and the error will go down as we increase the number of basis functions that we're using. And we can also do this for a cosine instead of a sine. The difference is that the sine functions only kind of test the odd Chebyshev functions. If you want to make sure that the even one's also working, we can do the same thing with cosine of pi of x. And you see that happens to be represented more exactly in this case here. Probably just coincidence. Okay. Now, I noticed that I'm not getting much feedback from you. I wonder whether we should go through the Mathematica notebook or through the general procedure again on a blackboard to see how the Chebyshev expansion works, how you represent things in terms of a matrix, and how the derivative operator finds a matrix representation, or whether we should just continue. I'll leave it up to you. Okay. Thank you. We can go over this in the afternoon, or we can look at a particular different example in the afternoon. Now, what I want to do is how to derive a matrix representation of a derivative operator in this particular form. And this is actually the remaining piece of code in the notebook, so it's quite compact. So we're going to spend 10 or 15 minutes or a bit more to actually go over that in detail and try to understand it. Now, if you have a function represented in terms of Chebyshev polynomials and you want to take a derivative, then the derivative operator as a linear operator then has a matrix representation for this particular basis for functions. And what we want to do is we want to find this matrix representation. So let's write this down. And we are going to find it essentially by trial and error. So we choose a particular set of functions where we know the derivative. We expand these functions, Chebyshev polynomials, and their derivatives as well. And this gives us a set of conditions for the derivative operator, because the derivative operator applied to the functions should give the derivative. A set of functions, let's call them f, and the derivatives, let's call them df, because we know that df equals d times f in the matrix language. From this, solve for derivative operator d. This, of course, in a certain sense, this is a rather stupid, straightforward way, right? We don't put any thought into how the derivative operator looks like or what it doesn't do. We just say we have a set of functions, and we know their derivatives. We expand them both, and this gives a set of conditions on the derivative operator. Of course, you can choose any set of conditions on the derivative operator, but given it's a linear operator, it's a 5x5 operator, we need 25 conditions, and then we just solve for it, and then we have the coefficients making up the matrix. This is exactly what computers are good at, where you just take a rather simple approach that has a lot of unknowns into it and solve it. And then set it equal, and then ask the computer to solve it. Of course, you can also derive the derivative operator differently, where you say, oh, we know the basis functions, we know the derivative, we know properties of Chebyshev polynomials, and so on, and can construct it there from first principles. Analytically, that would be very elegant, but it would be much more difficult to write it up. The respecting program would be much larger. Whereas if you just want to solve a 5x5 linear system, that is much easier to ask the computer to do. And these days, a 5x5 linear system is, of course, trivial to solve for a computer. So that's the approach that we're using here. In particular, we're going to use just polynomials for our functions. What happens here? X to the I, S, functions F. So I'm going to use here kind of a let expression in Julia. The let expression goes, hey, don't change from here to here. It's just multiple lines of code, and only the last line of code actually returns the result. It's just a begin and end. I could have used begin and end as well. So the function values, we're going to store them in a two-dimensional array. and the derivatives as well. This is a loop over all the basis functions, over all the I that make up our ansatz functions. Let me add a comment here. Here, we have an anonymous function, x goes to x to the I. That is the respective polynomial that we use. We sample the polynomial at the nodal points. This gives us the function values. And we convert it to coefficients. And I should have called this coefs. This gives us the coefficients to represent a polynomial in terms of Chebyshev functions. And then we're defining an anonymous function for the derivative of a polynomial. We know if I is 0, then the derivative of the polynomial is 0, right? X to the 0 is a constant function, derivative is 0. And otherwise, the derivative of x to the I is I times x to the I minus 1. And we do the same thing. We sample it at the nodal points and get the Chebyshev expansion of that. That is the coefficients of the expansion derivatives. And then we solve the respective linear system here. The backticks, the apostrophe here, means to transpose the corresponding matrix. As turns out, we defined them in the wrong way. So we take the transpose of the coefficients, and we ask, what matrix do we need to do? Do we need to convert the coefficients and the coefficients for the derivative? And we transpose that again in the end. And in the result, that what? Coefs not defined. Oh, sorry. Redefining things here. And this is the respective derivative operator, the matrix of the derivative operator that comes out. And it looks actually quite nice, luckily. And so if you apply the derivative operator, you have here your vector that contains the Chebyshev representation of something, and you apply that with that matrix. So the top element of that vector would contain the respective coefficient for the zeroth Chebyshev polynomial, that is the constant polynomial. And you see, if you do matrix vector multiplication, that coefficient is always represented with 0. So that coefficient always drops, as you expect. If you have a constant function, take a derivative, it does not influence the result. And otherwise, you have this nice triangular structure where you have 2, 4, 6, 8, 6, 8, and so on. It continues nicely, except things are off by a factor of 2 in the top row because the zeroth basis coefficient is always defined to something, always a bit iffy. Since this has such a nice structure, of course, it's well known. And we could also have coded that matrix directly by looking up on MathWorld or Wikipedia or somewhere. And what's here now? Let's delete that. And now we can also test that using, again, our function. And we do this by using a function sine of pi x. We're taking this function, again, getting the coefficients for that function. This is a vector. We're multiplying it with a derivative operator. Then we have the derivative operator. We can reconstruct the function. We call it d sine pi 1. And then we're plotting it. And we're plotting also the real derivative of sine pi x, which is, of course, pi times cosine of pi x. And this is the result. And as you see, the result doesn't look too great. There's kind of a 10% or 15% error in there. But this is just because we're using a rather small number of Chebyshev polynomials to represent the result. OK. Now, since we chose the number 4 explicitly above, we can now reevaluate everything with more Chebyshev polynomials. So let's just do that. So let's go to the top here, replace that 4 by, say, 8. And we define certain things that depended on nmax. So I want to throw away all these definitions. So we restart the kernel. And then I say run all, that reevaluates the whole notebook. And now let's see what happens, how fast that goes. All the outputs that have a star in front of it are currently being evaluated, and the other ones have finished evaluating. Currently, it spends time, a minute or so, again loading the plot package. No, what happened here? Oh, I don't like this at all. Oh, no, 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 this is not good. Oh, I can't go up to 8 because I defined the Chebyshev polynomials only up to 6. Haha, very good. So let's use 6 instead. Restart the kernel. And run everything again. Yeah, I should have also saved the previous output so that it can show that the new approximation is actually better than the old approximation. Okay. We're waiting here for the plot to appear. The graph now is much more busy. All the output becomes more complicated. And let's scroll down. Do we have, where's the derivative operator? Do you see it? This is the approximation of sine of pi x. It's now much more accurate. Before, the error was about 0.15. Now it's 0.01, so it's more than 10 times more accurate just by adding more basis, two more basis functions. And since sine pi x only samples the uneven, so the odd basis functions, so we essentially improved the error by a factor of 15 by using one more basis function in the representation. And that's rather typical for a Chebyshev representation. Each basis function that you add makes a world of difference. Cosine, similarly, very accurately represented. The derivative operator, now you see more elements of that matrix. So this used to be 8, 10, now we have 12. When we have 6, 12, next one would be 18, and so on. And the representation that was before rather bad is now rather good. You still see the difference. It's still a few percent of a difference, but still not be good enough for an accurate numerical calculation, but just two more basis functions. And if you add more basis functions, you can that basically arbitrarily accurate. And I might have mentioned before that if you use floating point numbers, you have about 15 digits of precision. So if you use more than 20 basis functions, your accuracy is so high that you're then limited by the floating point precision and not by the number of basis functions. So you need to use something else, either move to double, sorry, yes, to quadruple precision, or you need to split up your domain into multiple subdomains, and in each subdomain, use a Chebyshev expansion to be able to get a higher accuracy. Okay, now all this does here is essentially linear algebra. So what we did here is we take a problem that is inherently an analysis problem, namely a derivative operator resolving a PDE, and then convert it into linear algebra, something that computers are very good at. And apart from the translation, we are only using linear algebra to solve a problem. And here, the matrices that we used are 7 by 7 or something. This is rather small. Of course, computers can also solve matrices that are 7,000 by 7,000, or on a supercomputer, even higher. That is, this naturally extends to problems that are much more complicated, have a much higher dimensions, three-dimensional or three-dimensional time-dependent, that is, four-dimensional problems, and so on. And you can achieve a very high accuracy. Okay. In our Mathematica notebook, we went on to actually solve partial differential equations with boundary conditions and so on. I thought that would be too much to do here in a new language Julia, so I was going to skip that. But I notice we have a few minutes time left. So since I finished earlier, what is your choice? Should we finish the lecture earlier, or should we continue to work at boundary conditions interactively? Or do you want to know more about Julia, about other features? OK, yes?
Do you define a variable? Do you can define the type of the variable, whether it is an integer or a double or different kinds of variables? Can you also define whether it is global or local?
A variable?
Yeah.
I did not go into the details of this, but yes, of course you can. If you define, sorry, I'm just looking where a function was defined. If you define a function, a variable inside a function, it is local by default, but you can also make it global. If you have a simple script like this, then global variables totally make sense. But if you have a larger package, then local variables are much easier to use. Let me just go back to the other notebook and define something here. So if you define a global variable, let's call it x equals 4, and then we define a function x, the function f where we just return x, this now will return the global variable x. You can also define a local variable. If you define, say, y equals 2 in here, and then return the value of y, it's 2. But if you ask for the value of x, then of course it exists. If you ask the value of y, it does not exist because it is a local variable. And sometimes it's unclear whether you want a local or a global variable because you have both one of the same name. How should I say that? Yes. You can define a local variable x here. And then you can say global x this output. No, that was not good. 12. So first you define a local variable x, but then in a new scope you say x should be the global variable. Now x is the global variable because the local variable is shadowed, and if you output x here, you get the global variable, not the local variable. You see, it becomes very confusing in the end. So don't use global variables that have simple names like x, and try not to shadow variables because that's confusing, but that's possible. Okay. If you're interested in Julia, I should mostly point you to additional information. So there are, of course, things about learning and teaching, the tutorials, talks you can watch, and so on, if you're interested. What in particular interesting is packages. This is a large number of registered packages that people have written and made publicly available. Of course, they come from all corners, so I think 90% of these packages here are just uninteresting. I was actually looking for a different page here. Because sometimes packages get kind of grouped into groups of packages, and then you're probably more interested in the groups of packages. So for example, there's a group called Julia Diff that is a way to evaluate derivatives in Julia. And if you evaluate the derivative naively, you can make a large error. And if you use a package, then it's much better. Here's a bit of an advertisement blurb. And Julia Diff is, they call it an organization. So a group of packages is called an organization. It's probably they have their own web page and people contributing to it. And there's a certain number of packages. For example, there is a package called Forward Diff that as you evaluate a function, it also evaluates, sorry, the function f of x, it also evaluates f prime of x, or the gradient of x. And it does this rather efficiently. So if you need to know the derivative of a function, you can get that together while evaluating the function. And that works due to Julia's type system. Instead of passing in just a real number, it passes in something that satisfies a bit of a more of a complex algebra. Essentially, you define an algebra where your element is not just the real, but also a real and the vector representing the gradient of the function. And then every time you perform an operation that is adding or multiplication, that algebra sees to it that both parts of the result, namely the function value and the derivative, are calculated. That's called forward differencing, because as you evaluate the function, you kind of accumulate both the function and its derivative. And there's also a package reverse diff source, where Julia looks at the actual source code of the function, that is the expression tree, and from that expression tree evaluates the derivative. That is the same way you do the symbolic differentiation in Mathematica. So if you see x squared, then via expression manipulation, you get 2 times x to the 1 out, and so on and so forth. And derivative of sine is cosine, and so on. And there are other ways to calculate derivatives and other related packages as well. Here's something for sparse matrices, which is more efficient if the derivative of a function depends only on some of the arguments and not all of the arguments, and so on and so forth. And there are other organizations, if you're interested in plotting. There are probably 25 different plotting packages available for Julia. It's not good, because you want to use one, not 25. But one of the plotting packages is kind of designed in a very elegant way from first principles. Another way is just the wrapper around matplotlib, which is a famous Python library. And another package probably does things very similar to what they're done in MATLAB, and so on. So wherever you're coming from, there is something. And there's also something I wanted to mention about Julia. There are many computer languages out there, many programming languages. And you probably can't learn all of them, but you probably need to learn more than one, more than just Mathematica, at least if you're interested in using computers as a tool. And Julia is a rather modern language. Quite a few people here at Parameter use it, but it does not have the worldwide usage of other languages that, for example, Fortran or Python have. So it's kind of a cool and nice language, but it's not as mature as other languages. So you might, in the end, also use languages such as Python or Fortran that are more widely used, and then you'll see the similarities and the differences between Julia and the other languages. So I picked Julia because I think it just hits a sweet spot of the, in terms of the number of features it offers and the accuracy and the performance and the elegance and so on. But many other people would make other trade-offs with respect to languages and would have presented something in MATLAB or in Python or in Fortran. Yeah. So don't learn Julia simply because I tell you so. You might want to look around a bit. Okay. Okay, thank you. With that, I'll close the lecture, and I'll see you this afternoon for the tutorial.